power.
Welcome to Maximum Power, the Blake 7 podcast that knows the word is consanguinity, and we'll get more familiar in a family way with that later. But we're here to talk about Hostage, the 8th episode of Series B of Blake 7, and I'm joined today by the creme de la cremos. Let's introduce ourselves. I'm Pete.
I'm Colin, and I could murder a relaxant.
I'm Hannah.
And I'm Cy.
Welcome to Maximum Power, Hannah. Do you want to dive in first and tell us what's your overview of this particular episode?
I really love it, hence why I've volunteered to be here. And mainly for Travis. I like the development we've got to by this point with Travis. And whatever your opinion about both Travises, you know, it's hard having change. And this is the episode where I was really certain that I love Brian Crouch's Travis.
Fantastic.
Oh, there's not many people who say that.
I have a different view.
Go on then, Colin. What's yours?
I think it's one Travis episode too far.
How can you have too far?
I guess it takes us to Voices from the Past and eventually what happens to him. But it does feel like, yeah, oh God, here's another space battle to start with. Okay, we're down on the planet again. Oh, look, it's a quarry. And oh, we're trapped and Travis has an evil plan that he's trying to convince everyone that isn't an evil plan and actually is an evil plan. And he's sort of, you know.
That's literally the show.
Literally, yes. And thank you for listening to Blake 7.
I feel like you've named all the things that I love about it.
No, that's fine. Look, as our sort of godfather of the podcast, Peter Griffiths, always says, is there are no bad episodes of Blake 7. You know, even, you know, they're all great, even the bad ones. You know, I think I'm crazy.
There are no bad episodes, even the bad ones.
Something like that. We may have to check with Peter. That's what he said.
I
maybe
even the bad ones are good.
That's it.
Something like that. Yeah. And you know, this is very average Blake 7. It feels like by the numbers Blake 7. There's lots of things that we've seen in the show already. And I don't know whether this is one that Alan Pryor has come to write sort of very quickly or kind of last minute because something else has fallen through. But it feels like it's just taking bits of different episodes and mixing them into a new episode.
It's Seek, Locate, X-Bar, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Deliverance and all of those.
Well, people may call the battle sequence at the start padding, but I think it's really fun padding. I'd like padding like that in my life, I've got to say. Even though it's not particularly plugged into the rest of the episode, those first 8 minutes, they hit the ground running. And
I think you're right. I think, Pete, it's like when we were playing Elite back in the day. you had the basis of it, which is all the great sort of dialogue and people sort of urgently saying what speed they need to go at. And then you would imagine the rest. But there are some good bits. There's like this really good bit where it feels like in a space you have this sort of like red blood cells or something around the ship is all red on the outside. And I think that was a really nice sort of effect. But you do, is it Mr. Fibuli in that ship?
It is.
It's Mr. Fibuli.
Yes.
The nameless space commander. Although I think his name should have been Mark because he says that a lot. He's like, shoot them, target that weapon, Mark. I feel sorry for his mutoids who no longer have their hats in that scene. Maybe mutoids are now allowed to take their hats off. This is a breakthrough.
Maybe that's they can change it. They can have blonde hats if they wish.
They seem like different types of mutoids as well. They look older than the previous ones who've all been dark and very like very kind of sort of youthful looking, whereas these look a bit experienced.
Yeah, they're from an agency, maybe. Well, they're having a shortage of the usual mutoids.
Shortage of mutoids.
Yeah.
Well, there's the episode title.
Yeah, I know. But it is the Flintstones of space chases. You've got all these ships going past the same star field and all these things.
Blake gets the weirdest line at one point where he's like, the peak of it all. And Jenna practically gets the engines, can he take it kind of line, to which Blake replies, quench it, Jenna, full thrust. And that is just straight out of the Sweeney or something. I don't even know what it means. Does it mean put your foot down?
What
does it mean, shut up?
What is time to store? What is
what's
full
quench
thrust?
It? And what is but it's exciting. That's the point.
It's like someone's written, insert exciting space dialogue into the script.
Yeah, it's just when they say there's 20 ships, and you think they haven't got enough models to do this. We can't see this.
You cut between them all several times. It all adds up.
But, yeah. we do get during this space battle a countdown courtesy of CFAX.
Just
as something is about to happen. They do blow the hell out of the ship.
They do. And if I was watching that for the first time as a kid, and I don't think I saw this one when I was a kid, but if I had, I might not have thought, wow, are they actually blowing up the Liberator? As if that could ever happen. But that was kind of what I thought. They really went there with it, I think.
I feel like they achieved quite a lot with smoke and lighting and loud noises. And although kind of we've had sort of lots of space battles before, I think this one feels like them getting really quite vulnerable, like they are getting quite closer and closer. And rather than just sort of, we've taken a bit of a knock and the sort of camera's shaped a bit, actually sort of impacting like the flight deck really makes them feel a bit more vulnerable.
I think the actors now know how to do urgent acting for when they're in space battles. They know exactly how to pitch this now. And it's like a well-honed machine that they're all running around. They're all delivering their lines in the most urgent way possible. They're giving it everything to make it really exciting, which I think carries it when the model work isn't quite up to showing you what's going on outside the ship.
And then when they've blown up the bridge, they magically bring in the children's kind of playset table and chairs to have a little meeting on, which either were there before and just quite easily sort of nailed down, or they just sort of bring them in and they have this little meeting where Villa turns out to be even more of a massive idiot. It's like, it's like, oh, it's everything's changed. It's fine. We're going to be fine.
I don't know how many sets of tables and chairs they've got on the Liberator, because every week they seem to have a different one that they just bring into the flight deck and then take away again. It's really odd.
Is it like Only Fools and Horses and they're flogging them every time they need to get rid of something?
That used to be Gan's job. they've got too many of them now.
Yeah, we never saw the scene where Avon comes in and says, Jenna, there's a room full of tables up here that you must see.
And enough costumes to last us at least 3 years.
But not enough trousers for the girls.
No.
No, it's Space Laura Ashley on the Liberator.
I noticed meanwhile, back in the mutoid ship, as they're pursuing, one of the mutoids presses a button on a control panel a little bit too vigorously, and like the whole little semi panel that it's on almost falls in. It wobbles and goes in.
Oh no!
But we cut away very quickly from that.
I think Bea Lorimer is doing a good job at getting an exciting start to the episode, but it does feel kind of tagged on to what is actually going on, really, doesn't it?
Yes, and after the battle, we get to the real doings down on X-Bar, don't we? Well, we get summoned there first, don't we, by a mysterious message. I do love one of them.
Blake, it's Travis.
How
are
you?
I'm on X-Bar. I'm just calling you up to say I've got your cousin.
No, it's not your cousin. It's your father's brother.
And she
does. His father's brother every time. Why can't they just say uncle?
Because everyone has to work out. It's like, what is that, incest? Is that? Yes, it is.
Yeah, well, not technically.
But, what? Pete?
Yeah. Well, it's not. Cousins is, I mean, I've got Charles Dickens.
Each to your own, Pete. Off you go.
Charles Dickens and Albert Einstein both married first cousins. The Queen married a third cousin. But I don't know whether that's healthy or not. That's another matter. I just want to give a particular moment for Inga's reveal up on the scanner. She does an amazing ABBA video head turn as the camera comes around. Your cousin, and I'm doing it now, listeners, but I don't have the flowing locks.
Travis clearly has two cameras and editing software to cut between them. He's not just swung the camera around or dragged her into shot. He's made an effort at making this video really impactful.
Do you think they had a couple of takes? Come on, love, we've got to really sell this. I've got to trap him.
Halfway through the broadcast, he's like, Blake, sorry, can you just go on mute, please?
He's been on space TikTok for the Federation, hasn't he?
And it's absolutely not a trick this time, Blake. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, there's this thing in Blake's Heaven fandom, which I'm still a noob to, about Villa becoming an idiot. And it's funny because that's the Villa that I like. That's the villain I remember as a kid. And so seeing him, his path from being more acerbic in Series A towards becoming the guy who's always got the comedy quip or sometimes the or more the butt of the joke as well is an interesting path, because he's really good, isn't he? Particularly, I mean, jumping around a bit, but when he gets tortured later, he's proper sweating. He's really selling it in that scene, I think.
Yes, absolutely. I do love the bit where he's about to teleport down to the planet and Jenna is fussing over him.
Oh, yeah.
It's his first day at school. Yeah. Have you got your bag? Have you got... Turn it up. You stay warm. You're going to be
all right.
You
got your dinner money.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's sewn in like little labels into his coat and his shoes.
And I just know Sally Nevet sat there at that console writing a letter to her agent in very stern words. You're supposed to be a pirate.
Fuck all to do this episode. It's terrible. It's like, why does Villa need to go down? And sent Jenna with a couple of guns.
Yeah, or if Jenna had some kind of telepath who might come in handy on these missions.
Well, she seems to know what's going on and just sort of going, going on? Fuck it.
Yeah. I think this is the episode kind of point where you just realise they're never going to get involved again, are they? You have really given up on giving them anything to do, which it's gutting.
It's such a shame.
Yeah, they're such good characters, and they're both such good at it, and they've proved themselves and so over and over again in prior episodes, and then the scripts just stop. Bothering.
Callie hasn't left the ship since Horizon at this point, which is dreadful.
She's practically locked down.
Watching this through and adding it up, and you start working it out, and you realise you've gone half the season at some point before they've left things again.
Yeah, Jenna Lost went down in Pressure Point, and it's just awful. It's terrible. Colin.
Every time you can't stop yourself sniggering. Teleported down. There's no innuendo in that phrase at all.
But it's a terrible waste of those brilliant actresses and a terrible waste of those great characters that they're just sat there tapping their fingers.
Especially if you just drag Jenna down to just look a bit grumpy about Blake snogging his cousin.
And that's written as her, like, oh, she's jealous of it, but it comes across more like, ugh.
As it should.
Yeah. Reconsidering those allegations that were originally made against Blake.
Yeah. Well, it's like even Blake sort of, I don't know what mansplaining for flying the Liberator is, but he does it. It's like Jenna's just back at her console. He's just like bats her away and goes, it's okay, Jenna, I've got it. You're the pilot, but obviously I've got it. It's getting annoying now.
We've gone from Jenna teaching some of the others how to fly the ship to just Blake instructing her over everything now, rather than just... I feel she should just be going, piss off. Right? Just step back. I'm in charge here. You do what you need to do. I know what I'm doing here. Back off.
Yeah, it's like they've just refined everything down to Avon is duplicitous and untrustworthy of Blake, whereas Callie is completely trusting and does whatever he says. And it's like... They could be more grey, particularly on her side. You get grey on Avon's side, like in this one, and the whole thing that we're going to come to about him having basically betrayed them all quite colossally at the start of the thing by notifying Sir Valan. But Avon then gets the whole redemption sort of thing about being able to go in and save Blake's neck, whereas it just doesn't occur to them to give Callie a dinner or anything that interesting to wrestle with. It's very frustrating.
We do get a little bit of nice stuff between the two of them when they're on the ship together, and Callie is being trigger happy again and is blasting things with the main blasters, which is quite good. And they do the old teleport the Crimo into space bit again, so we get to see Vargos exploding again in a bit of stock footage. Which
I'm going to write letters to the BBC. That's not how asphyxiation happens unless you teleported it inside a bomb.
But how do we know? Could it be the energy release from the teleport that turns into an explosion when you're in space? You see, you've just got to use your imagination, Colin. You've just got to fill in the gaps. It's 70s science fiction.
So what do we think about Avon sort of changing his mind of, yeah, Blake, you go and do that. Put yourself in danger. We won't hear for yourself for a while. And then it's like, oh, God, do I have to save everyone again? Jesus. And then beams down. to very specific coordinates on a planet, which are 0, 2, 4, 6. Really?
How did they come up with that?
Just, exactly well, where
I
we
love
are.
I love that when Blake beams down, I mean, Travis just basically gives him a postcode. He beams down onto the planet, and first person he sees is his uncle. Ashton's your uncle. And well, I mean, and
he does seem to be the only person actually on the planet other than Inga and and the space crimos.
And the space crimos. And at the end, where Inga says, there's enough food here for all of our people. It's like, both of you? A multi-pack of mini Kellogg's cereals would keep you all going for a fair while. But this episode did have a really tragic production crisis, didn't it? Because the original actor, Duncan Lamont, sadly died after they'd finished all the location footage, hadn't he? Which he features obviously and really prominently. So, and then they had to go back and do it again with a different actor as much as they could. But there are some bits, I guess, where there are some takes that have still made it through from the original shoot, because you can see if he's not in them. But that must have been an incredible pressure on the cast. And going back to work again to reshoot scenes with someone who you got to know and work with, who then tragically dies. But that's got... talk about the show must go on. It's a weird, really weird situation for anyone to be in and filming like that, isn't it?
You sort of get an idea of what he would have been like, because he was in Death to the Daleks as Thingy, who betrays them all. He was a fantastic actor, and he would have been very good at this. But fair play to John Abernary, who comes in at the last minute and gives a really good performance, I think. He's very, very good in what's quite a confused part with limps and no limps, and is he a traitor or not a traitor? And, yeah, he's really good.
He's got an epic tash.
And another guest character that we see, who we only see very fleetingly, is Kevin Stoney in his amazing scene with Servalan. Kevin's familiar to Doctor Who fans, of course, as Mavic Chen in Master Plan, and Tobias Vaughan in The Invasion, where he spends all of his time shouting, Packer! Which he doesn't get to do with Jacqueline Pierce, who, in her three scenes, I think, again, just makes fantastic impact in this episode, doesn't she? That I love the way that she's just casually in her office at the start, swigging a glass of absinthe or something before
Midori.
And she does not like when he pulls that I got you where you are move on her. Her performance changes so sort of effectively into a different mode. And when she says, I value our friendship, you know, basically he's a dead man now, isn't he? And it's weird that we don't get more of that.
I think he's a great character. I really wish we'd seen him like pop up again, like as a recurring one, like someone like clipping out of her heels a bit.
Absolutely, because he's back in an episode of Series D, and he could easily have been the same character, and it would have been really interesting if it
would have really worked as well, yeah.
Because then there would have been the Slea Servalan thing as well, and whether he's noticed and, yeah, all of that. But I think he's absolutely superb. He's in full-on smooth mode, and he drags out the words Supreme Commander in a very, very elongated way, which is absolutely wonderful.
Yeah. You can tell Servalan's pining for Travis, can't you, at the start of that scene with a new commander, no name, just let down. She can't even be bothered. The way she just says mutoids, and they just kind of drag him off camera while he's like still trying to file his project review document with her. I would often like to do that on Zoom calls at work, perhaps. Mutoids! And they just drag the person away.
There's another really good scene with Servalan where I think she's saying something about the message arriving, and the mutoid is in focus all the time, and she's out of focus all the time, because normally, you know, you deliver one line and then you'd refocus on the character in the background, but it doesn't happen. The mutoid remains in focus all the time, and Servalan is still delivering her lines, and you can tell she's doing it in this just like commanding sort of calm and way. I think that was a nice bit of direction.
Was the message addressed to you?
That's how I should reply on everything to Twitter. Yes. Everyone who comes into my stream, I should just reply with that.
Yeah. And it's a bit somewhat hypocritical of Servalan, but then she is utterly evil, so I guess she's allowed to be. But where she's so disdainful of the mutoids, saying, you never criticize anything. And then the next time somebody criticizes her, she'll have them killed.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Why are the Krimos so shit? I mean, they're pointless. It's just like, because it comes up with like, and Blake sort of clarifies it as Krimos, criminal psychopaths. And I'm like, what is that, an anagram? No. What? Well, it's not even, it's nothing. You're not even adding two words together. But it's like, okay, criminal psychopaths. And then you've got that one guy, Moloch or?
Moloch. I think he, Moloch.
He does a reasonable job. And he's kind of like, because he's kind of psychotically smiling all the time. Hannah, what do you think?
I really like the idea of them. And the idea of having some people who are incredibly intelligent, but also very sadistic.
Scary.
I think we just don't see enough of that. Like, we've already, you know, since like season, I'll say that Travis is quite sadistic. And so it's, well, if Travis is hard, then why aren't we seeing this? They sort of shoving her around a bit, but they don't really, I feel that if they are like fulfilling that sort of psychopath bit, you'd expect them to be uncontrollable to an extent. And I'm not quite sure what the sort of the deal with them. I was trying to sort of ponder it out the first time I watched it, whether they are like escaped criminals or whether they are like a sort of little mercenary gang that you can hire. In which case, if people are hiring them, they must be willing to be controlled to some extent. And yet sort of I feel like, yeah, the very nature of them means they shouldn't. I feel like it should really have been a very Blake 70 thing that Inga should have died. Basically, because there should have been some moment where that's it. We see like what the Krimos can really do, and they accidentally kill her. There's not enough follow through on them. I wish we'd seen them again in episode. It just felt like there was a lot of potential there, and we don't see enough of it.
I think you're right, and I think the other thing is they've kind of, as you were saying earlier, they've demoted mutoids from being kind of creepy vampire, kind of ultra killers into sort of. You know, they've just had their purple rinse and they're just flying a ship
admin.
Now. Yeah.
I feel like the mutoids are very, like, regimented. Like, all they seem to do is follow instructions. Whereas it seems like the Krimos should be, like, a bit more independent from that. Like, the mutoids don't seem very intelligent.
Yeah. And they wear those masks, don't they? All of them, apart from the one who's got a name, wear those masks, which I think is that maybe a legacy of the, there's a bit in the script about there being not much oxygen on this planet. I wondered if that was a bigger deal in an earlier version of the script that then got taken out. I don't know, because that felt like an unexplored bit that was clearly put in for something.
I mean, it's a bit like Bane, isn't it, from Batman? It's like, hasn't he got like oxygen, extra oxygen coming into that mask? So they felt a little bit like that. But as you say, the rest of the, like, everyone from the Liberator that sort of teleports down, or any of the other, you know, normal regulars are just like, nah, we're fine. But the Krimos can wear them because it kind of looks scary.
And presumably they're fine when they're in the communications facility as well. Because arguably, when they're sort of running around, going uphill a bit, and looking a bit out of breath. But once everyone's indoors, you've got to start turning oxygen off before people start dropping down a bit.
Yeah.
It's just such a shame. It's a fascinating idea that's just underdeveloped. And again, this is what makes me think maybe this episode was written in a hurry, because nothing is quite there yet. It feels like it's two drafts away from being decent.
Yeah.
I love that Travis gets the line, "You underestimate my Krimos," which is an amazing line in any context. And then 2 minutes later, that one of them trips over a bit of polystyrene and plummets to his death. And the other one just slips on a stick or something during
the... Then they get crushed by polystyrene rocks.
I love the polystyrene rocks. But I think my favourite is the guy, there's the Krimo who goes over the cliff. I think it actually looks quite good. They clearly weighted the dummy somehow. It doesn't just look like sort of a bag of clothes. He falls really well.
Yeah, I think you're right.
A few comedy sound effects on that would be a marvelous thing. A few boinks and doinks as he bounces down the hill.
But I think you're all being very restrained, because I just can't help myself from just shouting, "Krimos!" every time we mention them. Especially that bit where Travis is stood in the quarry just shouting "Krimos!" and it's just echoing around the whole place.
They haven't got radios, obviously.
No kind of communicators.
No.
I really like this quarry. I've discovered I'm quite fond of a quarry, but I like that the script specifies it to be very cold, and it is clearly freezing.
Yeah.
You can see Lake and Ushton's breasts in front of their face at some point. It looks grey, blue almost at times, and icky white as well does make a difference from just the sort of the usual beige brown sand as well.
Yeah, and there's some nice filming that they've done at dusk. So the light is really good and really interesting. And then you get the night filming just for one scene at the end, which just looks amazing.
I think it makes it really atmospheric, that scene with Travis and Servalan being at night. And it means we get the point of view shot of Travis looking up at the Liberator in the sky, which I don't think we ever get another shot like that of like a point of view of like the Liberator from a planet. And you suddenly, why not?
Orbiting at a height of about 20 feet.
I don't know whether it was timing-wise or what, but I just find the dusk and the night filming a really curious choice because it's just not common at all in like programs of that period. And even a few years later, they seem quite hesitant about doing anything even just at dusk.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about this in Series A with the amount of night filming that the show got, which is quite a prestigious thing for the BBC. They don't do this very often because it's more expensive than filming during the day. So again, just to get that just for one scene is quite something, really.
Yeah, I wonder if it came out of necessity because of it having to be reshot while they'd already moved on to other episodes and they had to go back and do it again.
I did wonder this because the lighting seems to vary throughout sort of events that are clearly happening across one day.
Yes.
When they come out of the communications place afterwards, I always felt like there's some sort of filter. It suddenly looks very white or blue, and then suddenly we are into dusk and darkness.
Yeah, and there's that lovely scene, one of the first scenes, and again, it does clash a little bit, but it's so nice. Blake first beams down, and it's like the reeds with the mist when he first finds his uncle, and it's like he's on the borderline of the quarry.
There's quite a nice shot of Travis on the top of the hill, and so you've got the chalk white of the quarry, the white outline in his black outfit that works well.
I'm glad we all like this quarry because we're going to be seeing a lot more of it over the next couple of seasons, according to the locations guide.
I have a feeling this was David Maloney's favourite quarry because he used it extensively in Doctor Who.
Don't we all have a favourite quarry?
So it's in The
quarry?
Deadly Assassin, and for example. So
it's the same one. Is it Skaro from Genesis of the Daleks as well?
It is, yes.
Amazing.
So, yeah, I think this is just his goat. Maybe he lived nearby and thought, oh, well, this will be a useful one to film at.
There was probably a pub nearby.
You've got to keep Gareth Thomas happy.
If you can get there at lunchtime and back, then it's good.
Yeah. So we get a fairly, I think a fairly intense interrogation, torture-y whole scene for tea time slot. Although a lot of it's very silly. That scene, the scene with Villa being tortured, just, I don't know, I really felt that in a way.
Is he being tortured or is he just being threatened sort of shouted at a little bit?
Well, he's actually, he's sweating.
He's
having
a hard day.
The word.
He looks upset. What is the word to activate this teleport bracelet? Is the word.
Bracelet.
But it's very odd because Travis, who has studied extensively everyone on the Liberator crew, particularly Blake, suddenly has now forgotten everything that he's ever learnt about the Liberator crew, and he's just there asking Ushton, well, who do you think's the weakest out of this lot?
I mean, bloody hell, Travis, have you not been paying attention?
Exactly. So
why did they blindfold Blake before bringing him in? Why? He was stood outside the building looking at it. They put a blindfold on him and take it in just so they could go, ta-da, when they came in for impact.
It's because they want to disorientate him when he comes into that very brightly lit set.
That'll be it, yes.
I wonder if there's an alternative where instead of what happens to Travis in the last few episodes, instead they do team up and they do sort of team up to to fight the Federation, and then you're never quite sure whether or not Travis is on their side or not, or something like that. That would perhaps have been a different way of doing it.
Yeah, it feels very much like it would have been a really good idea to have Travis and Blake in an uneasy alliance. So who's your bigger enemy? Is Servalan a bigger enemy than Travis? So you do a deal with Travis to wipe out Servalan. And sort of, they could have done a really interesting thing about sort of the switching sides and can you really trust him, like you said, Cole? And that could have taken the series in such an interesting way. But instead, what we've got is Servalan's just got rid of Travis the week before last, and now she's just re-engaging him, but just on the sly. So it doesn't feel like we've actually got very far at all.
Well, that does happen in local government a lot, doesn't it? People get these golden payoffs and then get brought back as consultants, and it's basically exactly the same thing, I think.
When I first viewed it, I was really quite sad to see Servalan and Travis rejoin. Yeah, I liked the idea of the Liberator crew having two enemies, and it kind of feels like it's not really spelled out, but it kind of feels like the only reason Servalan's brought back Travis is that he has to be held accountable for his actions if he's not actually part of the Federation.
Yeah, and that's got legs of its own, but I wonder at the time how much pressure they were under, or what decisions they were making in the scripting about to what extent should we just do escapade of the week like they do on Star Trek, because that's what the show that this was always going to be being compared against, really, wasn't it? Or are we making a 12 episode long story like most other dramas? And I guess all the pressure on them was to just do a heist of the week. But
Blake Seven Flux.
Blake Seven Flux.
Yeah, I think they're trying this year to do a longer piece of storytelling, but I believe there was difficulties getting the scripts in that fitted what they needed to do, and that made it sort of more difficult when you've got a long-running story arc and you've got to get certain beats in, and then suddenly Terry Nation can't do the last two scripts, so someone else has got to do this. So we're looking for Star One, but we don't know that they're looking for Star One, because that doesn't happen till next week.
Spoilers.
sorry. Sorry, anyone who's listening.
It doesn't feel like we quite kick off the story arc until like Pressure Point or so anyway.
No.
Before that, we're just sort of carrying on with, like, say, Escapade of the Week. Maybe could have sort of slotted in stuff like Horizon a bit sort of further down. I think it does work where it is as well. But just to kind of space it out a bit and sort of give a bit more time for this arc.
I think that's right. I think they should have introduced Inga earlier in a different episode such that it has meaning, because they all come across as really stupid, right? Like you would have found a different way, or you've left it, or you've gone, no, we have bigger priorities. This is a trap. And then they all fall for it and they all get captured. And then, of course, obviously, magically, you know, everyone has to get away in the end. But it does feel like trying to make something grandiose that isn't like, some big plot, but it really isn't.
It's interesting that, like, Blake says he knows it's a trap. They think it's a trap. So I kind of think he'd go on down there a bit more on his guard, but it feels a shame that they all get caught very easily in quite ridiculous traps when we've seen them get past quite an awful lot. And just thinking back to Pressure Point of what they managed to get past a few weeks back. And yet it's all just really primitive stuff like nets and bear traps.
if they've been monkey bars, they would have had no trouble. They're good with them. I still want to see Servalan going over the monkey bars once she went down, because she went down there too.
The threat against a member of Blake's family should be a really big plot beat. That should be really huge, because we haven't seen any of Blake's family. And as far as we know at this point, all of Blake's family have been slaughtered. So this should be a really...
Right. The last surviving member.
Maybe a more emotional thing. But obviously, Blake Seven isn't always engaged with the emotions of the characters.
It's so terrible for women this week. It's like, it's the whole plot is around, you know, female in danger plot. And Callie and Jenna get nothing to do, even though they're the ones at the end that actually go, yeah, okay, this is a trap, right? We're going to take some action. And then at the end, where they just have this kind of 80s sitcom, they're flirting, aren't they, thing. It's a bit terrible in that respect. I don't.
It's odd that we have an episode called Hostage, but we don't really care about the actual hostage.
Yeah, she's not given very much agency in the plot at all. Although she does have the worst signposted elbow punch ever. Like, she's moving her elbow, ready to do it. She's going in. Oh, there she goes. But I think she gives a nice performance, but she's just not given much to work with.
Maybe yeah. Travis is the real hostage. I don't know. I don't think they're even wanting us to think that.
Well, you know what? You could actually have just have completely reversed, like, Ushton and Inga's roles. It could have been, you've got to come and rescue your elderly uncle.
Mm.
Quick, write to Chris Boucher in 1978.
So is this familial consanguinity, I googled it, romance between Blake and his cousin? It's in the text, isn't it? It's not just Gareth Thomas throwing in that and her throwing in that kiss at the end to shake things up a bit. It is implied, isn't it, that they were childhood sweethearts?
Yeah, we were very close once. He says something like that, doesn't he?
And they're about the same age. I think he's about 3 years older than her, something like that. So it feels like could this have originally been written as a pitch for a completely different series or just a movie that then got turned into a Blake 7 episode? Sometimes I think, because it's got this sort of strange other world already built around this guy who's been separated from his cousin and goes back to rescue her.
I wonder if there's something in where should she have been his cousin or should she have been like the ward of his uncle, something like that would have worked perhaps. Like,
yeah, that's how being a ward is a thing that's got a lot of script writers out of trouble, isn't it, over the years with various and it's all right, she's or he is my ward. Yeah, that's a good point.
This week is also the debut of Elizabeth Parker, who is taking over on Special Sound, and I think she is feeling her way very much on this episode because she gets lots of the sound effects wrong, and it really bugs me that the Liberator guns make the wrong noise. And she forgets to put the force wall sound on when they activate the force wall.
Well, we need to get her to a Blake 7 convention for you to give feedback.
In episode 4 of Series B...
Well, she adds really over-the-top sound effects to Travis's handgun. It's like... It's like when he's turning it on. Yeah.
It's very cartoony.
But so this is basically her first time being in charge of sound effects, having worked in sound effects. Right? Yeah. Well, you're gonna press all the buttons, aren't you, when you're allowed when it's your first time.
Does she do all the rest?
Yeah, she does the rest of the series now. So, and she gets better and better as she goes on.
Oh yeah. So when you get to orbit, when you've got all these sort of incredible, sort of weird, strange computer sounds in that room that the two blokes are in, I can't remember. Yeah. Haven't watched it yet again. You know, there's some really great atmospheric stuff going on.
Yeah, and she goes on to write them basically the score for Gambit, because Dudley Simpson isn't available or there's no time to do that. So she puts electronic music over that, and yeah, she develops really nicely.
She did David Attenborough's The Living Planet, I think.
She did. That's beautiful.
That's very good. Score. Yeah. It's like, yes, we've just found the pan pipe sound on the synthesizer. We're going to use it a lot.
And Time Lash.
And Time Lash.
Oh, okay.
I love that funky robot music from Time Lash. I'm robot dancing as we speak. So I think it's fair to say we've got a little mix of reactions to this episode among the panel today. It's got its pros and cons. Would that be a fair summary?
It's got its pros and crimos. It's fine. It just lets itself down with the characters just doing kind of stupid things. They should be smarter at falling into traps, you know, and I think that lets it down. But it's Blake 7, it's great.
I think I like how vulnerable the crew are throughout it, from the sort of space battle to Villa getting interrogated, them all being captured. It's the first time Travis has managed to actually capture them, and he doesn't want to kill them because he wants the Liberator, to seeing Avon covered in blood at the end. I really like it, polystyrene rocks and all.
I don't know. It's just all very average, isn't it? Alan Pryor gets a bit of a kicking generally for his episodes, but I think I said when we did Horizon that actually I think that one is a really, really strong episode. But I think for the rest of this series, particularly of Series B, he's drafted in at the last minute when everything else has fallen through. And I think sometimes that shows. So there's some great concepts and some really great bits. The opening 10 minutes with the space battle is really exciting, but it's just not quite there. It's just not quite developed enough to make it something better.
So you're saying it's all right. It's not a complete tragedy, which is what the Bee Gees would be singing about at number one this week in February 1979. Well, as this goes out. I think that's number one for a few weeks. I'm going to have to do variations on that line.
Did you say tragedy or Travis tree?
Is it a Travis tree? That's awful. I don't know.
That joke was a travesty.
I'll quench it. Thank you, listeners, for being hostage with us through this episode. Thank you, Simon, Colin, and Hannah, for being here with us. Next week, a Maximum Power squad will assemble to take you through a countdown. Until then, we'll say goodbye.
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 Bye.
Switching to manual. Maximum power on all drives.